Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I missed you.
I missed you more. I'm glad you're back in one piece, not in a body cast.
Me too.
Not
I'm
with a limp or a cane.
Yes.
You had fun out there?
We did. I took the kids, handsome husband and I took the kids out snowboarding to a friend who lives out in Colorado. It was a great trip. Happy to be back, and I'm a little sore, got to be honest.
But
not a kid anymore.
You're snowboarding and you're falling less, though.
Less,
right?
But each my butt still hurts.
Yeah?
Yeah, my butt still hurts.
All right, I'll take your word for that.
Each time I get better.
All right, good to have you back.
Yeah, so much to discuss with you. I missed you all. It was great fun. So thanks again for holding down the fort yesterday. When you were in school, did you get good grades?
I was an okay student, a B plus student, not a great student.
And you went to Penn State, but that's a good school.
It's a good school. It's hardly Ivy League, but the meteorology program had, I had to pass, there were three physics courses, chemistry, and six calculus. And the calculus,
that's
Jordana,
hard.
Nearly killed me. They wanted to prepare you in case you wanted to go on for your master's or PhD,
right,
which is all theoretical, all math. How we describe the atmosphere, it's all mathematics. So there was a lot of math, and it just about killed me.
When I worked for you at Weather Nation, mm-hmm. You hired meteorologists, and they
yes.
weren't all on TV. Many of them were, because we did produce shows, but some of them were, you know,
behind the scenes,
sure. That's right, researchers. And I was always the dumbest person in the room.
No, you weren't.
They are meteorologists by trade, I think, are very, very smart people. They really are. You're good with numbers, and you probably get good grades in school. Probably good students.
It's nice of you to say, but if we
you
were
are.
So smart, why did we pick a dumb profession where we know we're going to be wrong much of the time? And
that's actually a really good question.
We like a good challenge, right?
That's actually a really good question. I know for a fact that Dan Cook is smart, because John Williams' nickname for you, was it 38?
31.
31. Yeah. And just tell us why.
Because we all took the Wunderlich test, which is the test that they give like the NFL quarterbacks all the time to try and determine how smart they are.
Uh-huh.
And I think I got
And that's a good score.
On the show, yeah.
The highest score on the show.
31 out of 100 or no?
No, I think I want to say the max score was like 40 or something like
yeah.
that.
So
but
Dan,
the average was like 23.
Wow. Dan beat John.
Wow.
Yeah, Dan's smart. He's a smart guy. And Dan's good with facts and history and numbers, sports, things like that. Like, you were a good student then, right?
Yeah, I was good. I was okay.
He was an excellent student.
You've got a good memory. You did not do much partying as a young
no,
man.
No, I didn't do much partying as a young kid. My memory is really spotty, though. There's some stuff that I remember really, really well that's crazy, stupid. Why does anybody remember that? And then mm-hmm. And then I'll meet somebody and I can't remember their name 5 minutes later.
Trust me, your memory is good. I have a great memory from the 70s.
Oh, boy.
That really does not do me much good today.
Boy. The reason I asked this question is because the Boston Globe had some terrific reporting about valedictorians. They mm-hmm. followed valedictorians, people who did really well in school, and followed how their success in life followed. Now, specifically the Boston Globe story, if you go and read it, it was valedictorians that came from underserved communities. It was kids that were socioeconomically depressed. It was kids that didn't have access to great schools, children of color necessarily. It wasn't just your average, you know, Paul Douglas
suburban,
Dan Cook. Right.
Suburban school district.
It wasn't. But the reporting, and I urge you to read the story, it was out of the Boston Globe today, was fascinating. It tracked 93 out of 113 Boston public school valedictorians.
Okay.
So it's public school valedictorians from 2005 to 2007. Today, 40% of them make less than $50,000. Which is, $50,000 is a nice salary, but you think valedictorian, we're thinking doctors and lawyers and CEOs and, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They have this higher level of success that we expect from them. One in four fail to get a bachelor's degree in 6 years. Okay, so even if they might have had a full ride after the four, they didn't get their bachelor's degree. Hold on one sec. Nearly a quarter aspired to be doctors, but none of them have a medical degree. All right, 93 out of the 113 Boston public school valedictorians. None of them have a medical degree. And four of the former students have been homeless. Now, again, these were kids from underserved communities. They had started, you know, from whether they were socioeconomically depressed, what have you. They had challenged backgrounds. But what it showed was the fact that even though their grades were amazing, there was still that level of whether it was family continuity or access to networks, you know, because Paul Douglas's dad had professional other dads or friends that you could call on when you needed a job. You know, Dan Cook's dad was a cop. He had a network. He knew people. There were other dads around, or moms. Sorry, I don't mean to be other parents around that he might have been. Hey, Dan, I'm going to go into communications. Maybe his parent knows somebody. That's what these kids were missing out on. The conversation is a greater one, and it has to do with grades. It's okay that you didn't come from a socioeconomically depressed background, but did your grades in school affect the success of your life? What do you think in your experience?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I really don't think. No, I mean, in school, they teach you how to learn. But at the end of the day, I think most of what you really learn, you don't learn out of a book. You don't learn from a teacher. Mm-hmm. You go out and you figure it out and you make mistakes. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it is and I know a lot of people who are brilliant, but they can't complete a sentence. Right. They have no street smarts. Mm-hmm. They have no communication skills. And I think a lot of it is the network. It isn't just what you know. It is who you know and how you connect the dots and how you can put yourself in the right place at the right time, take advantage of the right opportunity.
I agree with that.
So it's not just SAT scores and, hey, I'm an A-plus student. I don't think that has a huge bearing on the rest of your life.
Then is there something to be said, and this is specifically for Dan because he was an excellent student, because you are always reaching for a better grade, you become a person who wants to do well and climb in your career.
I don't know if this is even necessarily the case. I think what school, and it goes back to Paul's point about, you know, school teaching you, you learn how to learn.
Right.
And I wish, at least in my education, and this isn't to knock any of the teachers that I had, but I wish that they had made a better point of that. Because you get into situations where I don't need to know how to do geometry, or I don't need to know how to, you know, and most people don't need to know how right. to use that kind of stuff. But understanding how that stuff works mm-hmm. helps you problem solve in real everyday life stuff. And I don't know that I'm just talking about my education, maybe it's totally different now, that there was enough of an emphasis on, hey, if you understand how to do this, this is how it's going to help you in life.
Yeah.
But so this is important to understand how to do this, not right. because you're going to be able to figure out what this angle means in a triangle, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. or what the Pythagorean theorem is, right? But but there are, you know, real-life applications, not for maybe specific things, but for the way that you go about solving these problems.
I do not consult college textbooks. The books that I used at Penn State, mm-hmm. I don't have any of my high school textbooks. No. But again, I do give thanks.
By the way, they don't have textbooks anymore. It's all on iPads.
It's all on iPad, yeah. All right. Thanks, Grandpa. But I had
a Chuck Burton.
We had them transparencies. Remember the transparencies of the grease pencils?
The best day at school was when they wheeled in the VCR cart.
That's right. I wanted to be on that AV team.
Right.
But look, I had a great seventh grade science teacher, Jack Danner, and Dick Batzer, my ninth grade teacher. They were science teachers, and they made the weather unit come alive. They helped to get me interested in weather. And then I went off and started reading other books and looking at other resources and going to the library. Remember libraries?
Mm-hmm.
And
I get conflicted about how to you know, talk to the kids about the grades.
Right.
Like as a parent, now certainly looking at this study, boy, we hammer our kids. You have to do well on the test. You have to get A's or whatever. You have to do the best you can. If you don't do well, ask the teacher if you can retake the test. But I constantly question that. You know, isn't 80% enough? Are we going to be okay with that? Are we satisfied with that because you're struggling? Or do we go ask to retake the test or extra credit? I don't know.
Grades are important. It's always good to do your best with what you're given. But I would argue that go out, get an internship.
Mm-hmm.
Do extra credit. Go for an AP, an advanced placement mm-hmm. in something. Distinguish yourself, mm-hmm. but go above and beyond. I think an internship, mm-hmm. Jordana, then you really see what's really going on. And
I agree. And grades don't matter there unless it's to get you the internship.
It's
so
the foot
it might
in the door.
Be a means to an end.
It's the foot in the door.
That's
Once
what it
your
is.
Foot is in the door, then many times you can rise up through a company. But people say, I'm worth more than 25 grand or 30 grand. I'm going to wait. I'm going to sit on my hands. If you wait and wait and wait, you're going to miss the opportunity. Hmm. Just get in. Once you're in, you can move up.
Rob's on the line. Hey, Rob, jump in here. Hi, Rob. Oh, sorry.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, guys. There's a great TED Talk from a guy named Simon Sinek.
Yeah, love him.
50 minutes long. And he talks about millennials and the generations after that. In that, part of it is that we taught them how to, because of technology, how to learn how to do. So people who are book smart become book smart. But I think what comes up is exactly what Paul is saying. In his talk, he also talks about the fact that we taught that you don't have to put an effort in. When we were kids, you had to get up and go to the video store and get a tape. Now you just sit on the couch and it comes to you. If you want food, you press a button, it comes to you. That we've taught the generations now to not put an effort out because it's so convenient that you don't need to effort. Also, that coming in last gets the same trophy as first. So the generations, once they get out of grade school and high school and go to college necessarily, that doesn't care. College doesn't care if you come in last or first or if you show up. They'll take your money regardless. But did we do a wrong as parents in not showing our children how to live out of it? I mean, most kids nowadays, I say kids, even 20-year-olds come out of grade school and high school, they can't balance a checkbook because they're not taught. They can't, you know, these things that everyday life comes in front of them are not ever shown to them anymore, and they have to figure out how to do this. They get really disappointed when it's not an immediate gratification. And it's kind of true. I mean, most kids can't balance their own checkbook or check their own bank account.
Rob, back to the grades part, though. You're saying getting good grades teaches them how to compete then? So it's a good thing to encourage them to get good grades?
Well, the good grades, I think, according to the talk, well, I see, the grades are great when you have somebody who, like Paul said, doesn't necessarily have street smarts. They know how to read. They can book their things. But once they graduate from high school, reality sets in. That if you're book smart, you still need to be street smart. How do you fight to get ahead of somebody else? How do you fight to get advantage? How do you fight to excel? It's not immediately gratifying. And in Simon's TED Talk, he talks about how these guys get a job making $100,000 a year out of college, and 6 months into it, they want to quit because they're not exceeding, they're not excelling. They want immediate gratification. Where books is just somebody showing up, do the books, do the work, and you can succeed. But it's not how real life works. You can be the best person and not get the job.
Yeah, thanks for the call,
true.
Rob.
Hey,
appreciate
thank you,
it.
Rob. Great point.
Yeah, thanks for that's the disconnect between grades and life. Mm-hmm. And there is a bit of a disconnect there. We'll talk a little bit more about this in the 5 o'clock hour. Think about it and jump in on the conversation then. It's 3:22. When we get back, a little shutdown talk.
And we have some breaking news on the federal shutdown. There may actually be a glimmer of hope that the federal government may be reopened. We have some breaking news. That's up next on CCO.
Little Bruce.
Right.
Hey, some breaking news. This just moved on the New York Times. Senate leaders reach a deal that could reopen the government by week's end. Jordana, the Senate will vote Thursday on two separate bills that would bring an immediate end to the partial government shutdown. One backed by President Trump that includes $5.7 billion for his border wall. Another that would simply extend funding for shuttered agencies through February 8th. The plan, a compromise between Senator Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader, and Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, offers the first hint of a path out of the partial shutdown now in its fifth week, which has left 800,000 federal workers without pay. The two announced this afternoon on the Senate floor.
Yeah, what's in the deal? What's in the deal?
Oh, you want details?
What's in the deal? Is there a wall? Is there a path to citizenship for the Dreamers? Is there amnesty? I doubt it. What's in the deal?
Chuck Schumer said people are saying there isn't a way out of this mess. Isn't there a way to relieve the burden on the 800,000 federal workers not getting paid? Isn't there a way to get government services open first and debate what we should do for border security later? Mr. Schumer said, quote, well, now there's a way. So,
but no details on the way.
No details on the specifics, but A, they're talking.
Okay.
And there may be a bipartisan deal. We shall see. But they won't vote on this till.
All right. Well, we'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah.
We now know TSA screeners missing work has hit a record 10%.
10%.
Because of the partial shutdown. This time this year, it was 3.1%. So it's a lot. I got to be honest, I did travel this weekend, and MSP is supposed to be the second airport with the longest lines, longest wait times, the second longest wait times in the country.
The Strip said Saturday the average wait time was 41 minutes, the longest in the nation that day.
I wasn't there Saturday, and I did go to Terminal 2.
And you were fine? They didn't give you any grief?
I mean,
you got through okay?
I got through okay, and I didn't have a problem. I'm sure other people are having problems. And then when we flew in from Denver, we didn't have a problem there either. So I wasn't seeing that. And I even had a conversation with the check-in agent, and I said, gosh, I really feel bad for the folks, the TSA screeners. And she goes, I know me too, but the airport's treating them well. They're being really nice to them. She didn't tell me about anything that's happening for them, but at least everybody, she works for Southwest, so she's getting paid. You know, she works for a private company. But I guess they're getting a lot of comments about that. She says, well, we're treating them really well here in Denver, and they're doing okay. So she was very empathetic toward them.
Hmm. All right. I brought this statistic up with you earlier today. Average salary of somebody in the FBI, what would you guess?
I would generally say that it was maybe lower than the valedictorians of $50,000, but I don't know. FBI, I think they're making a ton of money. They're really important people.
$37,000.
I don't believe that.
Average salary at the FBI is $37,000.
See, we have some people in the studio, some salespeople. We got John Schuster in here, and they're all looking very surprised at that stat.
Some of the agency's employees at the FBI are working as Uber drivers.
But were they working as Uber drivers before the shutdown because they're making $36,000?
I don't believe so.
Wow. They should be paying more. I really do. I mean, I don't know what their jobs are at the FBI, but you have to go through an academy. You have to be hopefully a really smart person, and I feel like they should be paid more.
Can you imagine your Uber driver turns around to you in the backseat? Yeah, I'm with the FBI.
Can you imagine? All right, shutdown talk. That's the latest on the shutdown. We will keep you posted. We're going to talk more about it in the 5 o'clock hour. Quick break, and when we get back, did your favorite movie of the year get nominated for an Oscar? We'll chat with Tim Lammers after the break.
All right, I want to welcome my good friend, my dear buddy John Schuster with Coldwell Banker Burnett into Studio A here at CCO. How you doing, John?
Doing great. Paul and Jordana, thank you guys so much for having us out. We were down here this morning, and we're super excited. Our home seller reform event we're hosting this week, and we just wanted to reach out to any listeners because we only have a few seats left.
Now, that's good. You're going to have a rare opportunity to learn some of John's secrets that have helped thousands of families sell their home quickly for the most money. What are you going to be going over at this forum, John?
So it's similar to our format last time, but we're going to go over three big things. The first one, three things all sellers must do to make the most money on the sale of their home. Five pitfalls most sellers make. And lastly, timing the real estate market right so you make thousands more on your home sale.
Perfect. And there are three separate events, so as many people can show up as possible. When and where?
Correct. Yep. And Mr. Paul Douglas will be hosting all of these, moderating them. The first one is tomorrow, January 23rd, 11:30 a.m., and also Thursday, January 24th at 6:45 p.m. Both of those are at the Plymouth Creek Community Center.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Saturday, the 26th at 10 a.m. at Braemar Golf Course in Edina. Do I got those times right? Yes.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yep. And there will be refreshments. And if you're serious about making the most money for your home, this event gives you real tips from real sellers that produced real results in the market. Space is limited. The last home seller forum sold out fast. Do yourself a favor. If you're even thinking of listing your home, register online at johnschustergroup.com. That's johnschustergroup.com. Thank you, John.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
She's back.
What do you think of the Oscar noms?
Pretty predictable.
Yeah, I would say so too.
Although Roma got more nods than I thought.
I didn't see that. What is that about?
I haven't seen it yet. It's on Netflix.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Period piece.
I've seen everything
Italy,
except The Favorite and Roma.
Right.
I know you weren't a big fan of The Favorite.
The Favorite was just bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And Dan, Black Panther's up. You must be excited. You said that was your favorite movie of the year.
That was easily my favorite movie of the year.
Yeah.
And I think it's absolutely deserving of a
I guess I forgot that it was this year.
Yeah, seems it was like early. It was February.
So, yeah, I mean, it seems like a long time ago. That was fantastic.
It was a great movie, and it was a cultural touchstone in addition to being a really, really good movie all on its
fantastic.
Own. And I think that absolutely deserves a Best Picture nom. It won't win, but...
I know. Yeah.
But the nomination's big. That's important.
A little disappointed Crazy Rich Asians didn't get in there.
I enjoyed that movie.
I was surprised. I would have thought that one...
That was another cultural touchpoint.
Cultural touchstone and very successful film, and a lot of people liked it. I was surprised that would didn't.
Comedies don't usually do it, though. Comedies don't get into the big.
Not always, but I think when they expanded the Best Picture nominations to 10, you open up the door for stuff like that to happen. So
it's a long list, my friends, and I was surprised to see Vice on there. I thought it was okay, but I didn't love it. Anyway, we shouldn't be talking about this because what do we know about movies?
Very little.
Our expert Tim Lammers is joining us. Tim, thank you for sitting through that brutal conversation about
what
we think.
No, that's fine.
Sorry, Tim.
Look, I'm just as big a movie fan as I am a movie critic, and I share the same feelings with you about many things. And you know, one thing that Dan brought up about the Academy has the ability to nominate 10 films, but since they instituted that rule, they generally cut it off at 8, maybe 9, and I think that's one of their big problems, because just nominate 10. If you can nominate 10, a Crazy Rich Asians might sneak in there,
right.
A Mary Poppins Returns might sneak in there, because those two films were lauded by the Producers Guild of America. You know, so I thought people probably thought it had a pretty good shot coming in, both those films of being nominated, but they didn't. And the problem is that disconnect between the Academy and the general viewing public is part of the reason why viewership is not there. They're not going to tune in to watch awards about a bunch of films that nobody has seen, or actors or directors or actresses that they, performances they haven't seen. So I think this is another typical year. I guess, Paul, like you were saying, predictable. Yeah, I mean, you just come to expect that you're going to get some stuff like A Star Is Born, but you're also going to get stuff like Roma that a lot of people haven't seen. The Favorite, a lot of people haven't seen it, but yet the critics and, the industry folks, they seem to find something in it, and they want to award it.
I wish Bohemian Rhapsody had gotten more nominations, more nods, Tim. I still, that movie kind of crept up on me, and I really think the acting was amazing, and talk about overcoming obstacles. And Freddie Mercury, obviously kind of a tortured soul, but just that whole arc of his life and what he accomplished. I mean, getting opera on rock and roll stations worldwide. I mean, only Freddie Mercury could have done that. And I think it's a remarkable story.
I think it is, too, and remarkable for what happened during the production. I mean, the director, the original director, even though he was credited, got fired during the production. Somebody else took over for the last couple weeks and oversaw post-production. Movies like that are generally doomed. That just goes to show you how strong the performances were, especially by Rami Malek, who was nominated for Best Actor. But I think there were any number of folks in there, whether they played the band members in Queen, or the manager Jim Beach, or John Reed, the woman that played Freddie's love, Mary Austin, she could have been nominated as far as I'm concerned. So, it had strong acting across the board, which I think was reflected in the Screen Actors Guild nominations, which did honor it with a Best Cast Ensemble nomination. Now, those are going to be handed out on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, that SAG nomination, that Best Ensemble deal, equates to like a Best Picture nomination in Oscars world. So, apparently that movie hit the right emotions with Oscar voters to include it in Best Picture. Again, which is the ultimate, compliment that can be paid to any sort of picture, no matter how much the critics loved it or hated it. Of course, I'm in the camp of not only loved it, but loved it and thought it was one of the best pictures of the year.
Yep.
So who's going to win, Tim? Give us some thoughts.
I can tell you, hands down, and I may have said this before, but Lady Gaga will win an Oscar, but not for Best Song. For Best Song, she will win. That film is, that song, it's hands down, it's a lock.
Really?
I think that Glenn Close will win Best Actress. She's been nominated. This is her seventh nomination. She's never won.
Really?
She's now in Paul Newman territory. And there was Al Pacino territory where it took them seven times to be nominated to win. So, and it's not a charity Oscar either. This movie's coming out on streaming in a few weeks, and we'll talk about it more then.
Okay.
But Glenn Close's performance in this movie is magnificent. It really is something that is a nomination that's well-deserved. So, you know, at this point, if I'm going to say there are locks, it's for Best Actress and a lock for Best Song. Otherwise, you know, it's somewhat unpredictable. I mean, when A Star Is Born, I thought that was going to sweep through award season. When you get a director like Bradley Cooper not nominated, that seems to hurt the chances of the picture being
right.
The Best Picture winner. So it's going to be tough. You know, it'll unfold once the SAG Awards are handed out and the Directors Guild Awards are handed out and so on and so forth. Once those industry prizes are handed out, that generally is the best indicator of who and what will go on to win, just because you have the same sort of people voting a lot of the times.
I have to say, I really, even though The Favorite was stunning in terms of the sets and the costumes, and I mean, it was way over the top.
Yeah.
Other parts of it were troubling.
He hated it. Just be honest. He thought it sucked.
I was not a fan, but I did love Emma Stone. I thought she deserves supporting actress for The Favorite. I also liked her in Maniac. Did you see Maniac?
No, I didn't see that. That's a Netflix show.
Netflix, yeah, with Jonah Hill. That is right. Definitely worth
Jonah
your
Hill.
Time to see.
Well, you know, The Favorite, and Paul and I talked about this last week, Giordano, when you were gone, but I wasn't a big fan either.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really overrated. I won't say it's a bad film. The performances, I personally like Olivia Colman out of the three, and she really belongs in the supporting category. She doesn't belong in the best actress category, but they've already, you know, you have Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone already nominated. So to put those three together in one category, they're going to split the vote, and you're not going to see a winner from either. Yeah, so the Favorite is not one of my favorites. How about that?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, who's going to win Best Picture?
Well, at this point, I think it's really going to come down to Roma. And
really? Do I have to see this movie?
And, you know, I'm not saying because I want it to win. I thought that movie is overrated as well. I really do. And I'm shocked by the nomination for the lead actress when you have people like Emily Blunt out there, you know, for Mary Poppins Returns, mm-hmm. or Toni Collette for a scary movie called Hereditary, which is a chilling performance, and she didn't get a nomination. So I'm only going by, you know, what the industry is leaning toward at this point. But I'd say Roma, I'd say possibly Green Book, only because that won the Producers Guild Prize last weekend. But again, Peter Farrelly was not nominated for Best Director, so there doesn't seem to be the full Academy support behind that film either. Personally, I'd love to see A Star Is Born. Now, could that win without the director being nominated? Yes. Argo is a great example of that. Ben Affleck was not nominated for Best Director, yet he won the Directors Guild Award for it, and then the film won Best Picture, which he was a producer of. So he got an Oscar anyway. So who knows what people are thinking here with these films and how they vote.
Tim, I feel your pain. I can almost hear you squirming as you look into your crystal ball.
Well, I'm filling out my brackets, Tim. So, I'm filling everything out. So I'm going with all your picks.
Just a tip to those folks out, you know, that have Oscar pools and everything. Pay close attention to the Guild Awards, the Screen Actors Guild, the Writers Guild, maybe not as much. But the WGA Awards, and then also the Directors Guild. Generally, the Directors Guild winner almost always goes on to win the top prize. Now, having said that, three of the five people that were nominated for the Directors Guild went on to be nominated for an Oscar. Two of those did not. So Peter Farrelly and Bradley Cooper, so you can take them out of the equation. Makes the race for Best Director for the Oscars a little more interesting.
Hey, Tim, you're on a roll here. How many inches of snow Sunday afternoon? Come on, just give me a number.
I'm an Oscar prognosticator, Paul. You're the weather prognosticator. I'm just going to throw 3 inches out there. How
All
about
right.
that?
That's a good start. Who is it? Yogi Berra said predictions are tough, especially about the future. And I feel that every day, but I feel your pain too, Tim, and thank you for being a good sport.
If the snow falls, you can at least take in some of those folks, the performances or those pictures. A lot of these pictures are streaming right now, so you should be able to get them. This is a good weekend to catch up on all those Oscar-nominated films.
Sounds good.
Tim, you're the best. Thanks for everything. We'll talk to you on Friday.
All right, Tim. Thank you. See ya.
All right. It is now 3:47 Wicks and Jewelers time. If you haven't been to Wicks and Jewelers before, you do not know what you're missing. Stop by today and experience the Wicks and difference for yourself. I've said this before and I shall say it again. If the product or service is free, you and your behavior are the product.
It's true.
And you know, a lot of people addicted to Facebook, a lot of people addicted to Google. I'm one of the ones. I mean, who doesn't use Google every day? Some people are arguing we are in the midst of a transformation every bit as big as the invention of the printing press back in 1439. A new book from Shoshana Zuboff called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism says that there's basically a new version of capitalism in the works. It's called surveillance capitalism, Jor. It works by providing free services that billions of people cheerfully use, enabling the providers of those services to monitor the behavior of all those users, all of us, in astonishing detail, often without our explicit consent. To the point where Google can anticipate now what you will do now,
that's
soon,
right. Mm-hmm.
Or later, and companies are willing to lay bets on our future behavior. It's even more than just targeting advertisements. It's knowing where you've been. It's knowing where you'll probably be next month and selling that data to other companies. And I think there's already an outcry. The Europeans just fined Google $59 million for not adhering to their new privacy regulations in Europe. I would argue Europe is 3 to 5 years ahead of the United States. We just give away our data. We give away our location data.
I'm surprised, as an entrepreneur, you don't see this as a new market, an emerging market. Well, now we can, you're not creating anything, but it's intellectual property, using people's habits and making, I guess, a profit or a business out of that.
Yeah, George Orwell would be thrilled with this. 1984. Let's track people, not necessarily on a camera, although you are on camera much of the day, whether you realize it or not, if you walk around in the skyway or on a city street. But it's that incessant surveillance, digital surveillance, and all of us leave these little breadcrumbs. And there are companies that are very happy to hoover up these breadcrumbs and sell them not just to advertisers, but to other companies that are trying to predict our future behavior.
Shoshana Zuboff say that it's bad to be in a surveillance economy, or she was just noting it?
She's noting it and basically saying that you have to give Americans the option of opting out, or at least be transparent. Tell them they're being tracked 24/7.
That makes sense.
And maybe, hey, Facebook, I gladly pay $50 a year. Don't track me. I'll pay you $50 a year.
So that's the alternative.
Keep my data private. I want my data only on Facebook. Do not sell it to anybody else.
We're going to talk more about this in the 5 o'clock hour. But up next, should there be a tax for porn to help pay for the wall?
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.